The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Buddha's enlightenment can be described as simply seeing things as they truly are. What we usually do is see them through this filter of self. And so we don't see the things themselves. We see whether we like it or don't like it, or our ideas and opinions. So I want to read a quote from the Sharangama on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas see things. The Buddha said to Manjushri and to the rest of the great assembly, to the thus come ones, to the Buddhas of the 10 directions, and to the great Bodhisattvas who dwell in Samadhi, visual awareness and visual objects, and the objects of mind as well, are like elaborate mirages that appear in space. They have no real existence of their own. Fundamentally, visual awareness in all its conditioned objects are the pure, wondrously understanding enlightenment itself. In this enlightenment, how could there be an identity or lack of it? When I put on my kesa in the morning, there's this lovely verse from, I believe it's the Shishogi. It says, within these precepts dwell the Buddhas, enfolding all things within their unparalleled wisdom. There's no subject or object for any who dwell herein. No subject or object for any who dwell herein. All things, earth, trees, wooden posts, bricks and stones, become Buddhas once this refuge is taken. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking, the awakening to true wisdom. This idea of getting beyond self and other object and subject and object, getting beyond the dualistic mind, is to be able to see the impermanence of all things. 40 years ago, this building wasn't here. In another 40 or 50 years, it'll probably be a different building altogether. And it'll have different people in it. But they'll all be studying the same thing. And if we see everything as impermanent and see ourselves as constantly evolving and changing, then we aren't quite so attached to this self. And then the Buddha asks Manjushri, Manjushri, I now ask you, you are Manjushri. Is there a Manjushri about whom one can say, that is Manjushri? Or is there no such Manjushri? So Manjushri answers very politely, says, neither, world-honored one, I'm simply Manjushri. There is no one about whom one can say, that is Manjushri. So why? If there were, there would be two Manjushris. There would be Manjushri and then there's the people who wanted to think they know about Manjushri. And that's really the crux of what I'm trying to talk about here, is that we don't see Manjushri, even though I brought a picture of Manjushri here for you to look at. When I look at that picture, I don't just see Manjushri. Because I got that picture in 1974 when my sister died. She had a Japanese airline calendar from 1973. And this was a picture from the Japanese airline calendar in 1973. And this is a really beautiful frame that someone had found in the dump. And it was broken and needed to be fixed a little bit. And I've had it for 40-some years now. And I don't see it just as Manjushri. I also see it as a gift from my sister. I see it as a gift from taking things out of the dump and finding a good use for them. I see it as a lot of different things. And that's the point of how we see things through this filter of self. We don't just see Manjushri there. And Manjushri just sees Manjushri. And he just sees the world through this eyes of enlightenment, where it's like an elaborate mirage as they appear in space. They have no real existence of their own. Fundamentally, all these things are the pure, wondrously understanding enlightenment itself. But we have to look with these eyes that are not clouded by our ideas and opinions, our likes and our dislikes. When you like somebody, you're likely to listen to them and think, oh yes, of course they're right. And when you don't like somebody, you immediately dismiss them without even hearing what they have to say, because you already know you're not going to like it and you're not going to agree with it. Our government runs like this. And it's important that we see how it is that we distort things. It's like putting light through a prism and it comes out in all these different colors. The clear white light is no longer clear white light. It's red, yellow, green, white, purple. It's all these other colors. And that's how we filter what we see. We filter it through this likes and dislikes, conscious sense that all, it's very simple. All you have to do is giving up picking and choosing. It's not all that difficult, except we're so conditioned. Our greeds and angers and fears control our reactions to things. So instead of letting those go, we react to them. And the whole purpose of our meditation is to get to some place deeper where we're not simply reacting out of our emotional conditioning. And we can just see things as they are. But we have to see ourselves first, as we have to see how we deceive ourselves, how we distort how we look at things. Because you can't change that until you can see the error. And that which understands the error is not itself an error. That which understands the error is the Buddha mind that's trying to point out that no, it has nothing to do with your likes and dislikes. It has nothing to do with you at all. It just is as it is. But to be able to see things as they are, you have to get the self out of the way. The Buddha then said, the same is true of the wondrously understanding essence of our visual awareness and also the objects we observe in space. All are the wonderfully, wondrously understanding supreme enlightenment, pure and perfect true mind. It is a mistake to consider them as separate, as observed objects, space, and visual awareness, or as awareness of sound or other kinds of awareness. What he's trying to point out is that the awareness itself is the Buddha nature. We all have it, but we all also distort it. And we have to see what it is that we are doing that distorts that awareness. We have to see when we're griping about somebody and saying, oh yeah, they always do that. Well, maybe that's not true. Maybe they don't always do that. Maybe that I don't always have to be bugged by it. Maybe I can just let them do what they do and not be bugged by it, not be bothered by it, not like it or dislike it, just see it as it is. What if you're in a traffic jam and you're stuck there for 5 minutes? Why don't you just meditate? Enjoy the fact that you don't have to drive. Or you could get all worked up and you're going to be 5 minutes later than you hope to get there and whatever. I mean, we have to see how we create the suffering out of the situation. The situation, the conditions, are not the source of the suffering. It's how we react to them. And our reactions are something that we have a small amount of control over. Because we can see what it is we're doing if we're meditating. If we're still enough in our meditation to actually see how we are reacting emotionally and realize, oh, It's like being offered a distraction, and you decide, not for me, thanks. I heard a talk that Master Daisu gave about addictions, and he said in Canada, instead of saying no, he says they say, none for me, thanks. They're very polite. Well, we have to see that we are being offered these addictive things, our fears, our greeds, our desires, our aversions, our likes, our dislikes, our worries. All of these things are being constantly offered to us by Mara. Mara is the chief tempter. And these things get thrown out from our minds because we're conditioned to buy into them. And we have to see that we are conditioned in that way. And we have to, when we see that, we're seeing from the Buddha nature. When we see the self getting in the way there, when we see the fears or angers or greeds or our likes and our dislikes, it's the Buddha that sees those. It's the Buddha that just says, no, you don't have to react to that. You can just let it go. You don't have to get involved in those things. It's like constantly we're being offered this addictive heroin of angers and fears. And we buy into it because that's just what we're used to doing. And we don't have to turn pain into suffering. The pain itself is just sensation. The suffering is not wanting it to be there. So as I get older, it's a little harder to get up and down with bowing these days. But it's just being as old as I am. And I know it's not going to get any better. In fact, it may get a little bit worse. And it really just doesn't matter. It's just what the body does. And when you don't buy into the fact that this is a big deal, then it becomes less of a big deal. It's a very subtle little shift on how we perceive things. And when somebody, say, insults you or does something rude or interrupts you or whatever, and you can get upset about that, or you can just let it go. It fundamentally doesn't matter. But if you get all upset because you don't like that, then it does matter. And the matter is that matter is the suffering that we put on to the situation. And every time something comes up that we don't like or that we do like, then we either grab at it because we want it or push it away because we don't want it, rather than just see it as one of these passing mirages. It's not real. All of these things are just, you know, they're temporary, everything. We're all temporary. And buildings are temporary, people are temporary, dogs and cats are temporary. This moment is the only thing we have. And that's permanent. And it's just the present moment, and everything else is changing. And so if you come back to this present moment, well, you're okay. I mean, you might be a little bit bored by my babbling, but you're okay. You can handle this. I'm going to read this again because it's really important. To the thus come ones, to the Buddhas of the 10 directions, to the great bodhisattvas who dwell in samadhi, visual awareness and visible objects, and objects of mind as well, are all like elaborate mirages that appear in space. They have no real essence of their own. Fundamentally, visual awareness and all its conditioned objects are the pure, wondrously understanding enlightenment itself. In that enlightenment, how could there be identity or lack of it? It's simply all the Buddha nature. Everything. Everybody, everything, every blade of grass. Every cloud that disappears. Every emotion that arises. It's just emotion arising, so big deal. Just because we are conditioned to have these things arise and we don't have to react to them. we can learn to respond. There's a lovely line in this old movie, the video that I saw many years ago. It keeps sticking in my mind. It was the BBC's version called The Great Search, and it was their section on Buddhism, and they had an interview with Ananda Maitreya, who was this old monk who was in his late 80s at the time. He lived to be in his 90s. He was a wonderful human being. And he said, they showed this ordination of a little 9-year-old boy, and after his ordination, his parents and his grandparents bowed to him and gave him gifts. And one of the things that Ananda Maitreya said, "Don't worry. If he gets above himself, we can help him down." Wasn't put him down, it's help him down. He also said that a man who doesn't love himself cannot love others. And we have to learn how to love ourselves. And that loving of yourself starts with the meditation. Learning just to be there, just to sit still and just be there with yourself. This is a very powerful thing that transforms your life. If you can just be there with your grumbly, old, greedy, fearful, whatever self, and just be there. You don't have to make it any better. You don't have to change it into something wonderful. It already is something wonderful. You just have to appreciate it. But most of the time, because of our conditioning, we're told there's something basically wrong with us just because we're born. And we've got to get over these conditions. Our master said one of the hardest things is to learn to forgive ourselves for having bought into the delusions that our parents and teachers have sold to us. But we have to see that we are deceiving ourselves in this way, and we've bought into these delusions. Because you can't change them until you see, I'm acting out of that fear, or I'm acting out of greed, or I really don't like that person, so I'm not listening to them. And you're treating them as somebody who doesn't need to be listened to. And when you do that, you're cutting off part of yourself. Because it doesn't matter whether you agree with them or disagree with them. It does matter whether you listen. I have a friend who's dying, and the nicest thing about her doctor is the doctor comes and just listens. And every time she comes, she listens, and she offers some more medicine. The person doesn't want any more medicine. But she does want to be able to talk to the doctor. There was a lovely book called Kitchen Table Wisdom by a woman who was a doctor, but she had Crohn's disease, and she was talking about doctors who treat cancer patients. And all they have to do is the chemotherapy. They didn't have anything else to treat. And this one doctor, he told the cancer patient, he says, "Well, it's not working. I don't have anything more to give to you." And the guy wanted to come have another thing because he wanted just to talk to the doctor. And that wasn't part of the doctor's protocol. He wasn't programmed to say, "Why don't you just come on in and we'll talk for an hour a week?" Because that's all the guy really wanted. And that was what's going to help him, is just have somebody listen to him. He just needed a friend. And the doctor was just that person. But the doctor was programmed to think, if I can't give him therapy, I don't have anything to give him. And he didn't realize that he could give him his attention. He could listen. He could just be there. He could just love him. And that's all he needed. I did a memorial yesterday for a couple who both died within the last month, within weeks of each other. She had been deaf from birth, so she didn't know how to speak either because she never heard language. But she was an incredible communicator. And she was a very, very loving person. And she made it very clear how much she loved people. But she loved herself. Her sister-in-law was saying, "Your mother must have done something really wonderful because she truly loved herself and she loved other people." The doctor told her about 2 months ago that she had cancer and was going to die. There was nothing they could do about it. And the sign translator was there, and She got it, and she looked glum for a minute. It was only maybe 10 seconds. Then she looked up and she gave the doctor a huge smile and made, "I love you," sign to the doctor. And that was her reaction to the news about having cancer. And it was just amazing. I mean, this woman, I met her only a couple of times before she died, but she had two social workers, she had a translator and a conservator. And these people went out of their way to help these people because she was so loving. And it was just that she had to learn to communicate from her heart whenever they were having to use words. There was a story in Zen Seeds about a lady who she had been a geisha in Japan, and the person who was her lord went berserk because he was found out his wife was sleeping with somebody else or something, and he killed all the people in this geisha house except this one woman. She lost both her arms, and she became a Buddhist monk, a nun. And she said, "Well, the birds, they don't have any hands." And she started to write poetry, putting a brush in her mouth to be like the birds. And she wrote these beautiful poems. And she used her limitation to her advantage. It didn't stop her from expressing her Buddha nature. And somebody, we were talking about that story, and somebody said, how sad it would have been had she been 65 years old as an old geisha and had beautiful hands, but was no longer physically lovely. You know, and instead, she became this beautiful monk who wrote this beautiful poetry and communicated from her heart. And she, and the same as this deaf woman, she was such a loving person. And she was so willing to tell people how much she loved them that they all wanted to help her. The translator said, a couple of people came up to her at this meadowlark home where she was living and wanted to learn sign language because they all wanted to be able to talk with her because they all could tell that this is a remarkable person. And she thought, okay, well, a couple of people show up. So she arranged for a class. Well, 15 people showed up for this class. But this was, you know, whatever limitations you have, they don't limit your Buddha nature. We limit our Buddha nature by clinging to our greeds and our angers and our worries and our fears, our likes and our dislikes. Because we distort this original purity that's already there by not being able to see that. And it's changing our perception is a very subtle little thing. It's like looking through a lens and turning it and coming it into focus. Or a radio station that's all this static and you just make a little adjustment and it's right clear. And that's exactly what we have to do, is to make these little fine-tuning adjustments in our perception of things to see how we create the suffering out of our fears and angers and our conditioned reactions to things. And that we have a choice. Like my little niece who's had the nemesis dragon and was giving me all these little gifts, and I was saying, oh, I think this nemesis dragon is getting converted. And I started getting more and more gifts. I ended up with a little girl's umbrella, which is a clear plastic with purple and pink flowers. And I said it that way. I said, wow, this nemesis dragon is really getting converted. But the nemesis dragon did not want to speak. But it was getting converted. And this conversion is what we do when we start loving ourselves. The four wisdoms, the bodhisattva mind, these are all ways of loving yourself. Tenderness, benevolence, sympathy, compassion. Keeping the precepts, being generous. I mean, it's all right there. all the Buddha Dharma is trying to explain to you what it is that you need to do in order to be a loving person. And you already know how to be a loving person. You just have to do it. It's not that you have to get information. You just have to learn to take that information and manifest it in how you deal with yourself and others. And it's not that difficult. In fact, it's a lot easier than hanging on to our fears and grumbles and dislikes and all of those things. That takes a lot of work. Suffering actually is enormously difficult. I got depressed when I was a teenager after my father died, and it was just too much trouble. Because a being is a natural, joyful thing. And there's just a joy in being alive. And if we don't realize and can't realize that, well, just keep meditating, because it'll pop up all on its own. You just have to get yourself out of the way. And it's just not difficult. It's just that you have to do it. And you have to see where you're creating this self and other, and seeing, I'm looking at you, and seeing how, whether you're seeing a you there or whether you're seeing the Buddha there, depends on how you look at it. And it's taking off this filter of self that allows you just to see things as they are. It's not difficult to do. Let's see what else I was going to say. I did have notes. Picking and choosing. I think I've done just about everything. We have an infinite source of compassion. Remember Master Chusin wrote this beautiful song when he died, just before he died. And he describes the Buddha nature as that which fills and contains all things. And when you realize that, that what fills and contains all things is this infinite loving kindness and compassion. And wisdom. Don't forget wisdom. You can't hear me in the back row. I have to speak loudly. I don't speak loudly. We have to see the self as something that is constantly evolving and changing. It's not a fixed entity. The Dalai Lama talks a lot about emotional maturity. He had, I saw this video where the scientists spent the day explaining relativity and quantum mechanics to him. And at the end of the day, he said, well, you know, when you get a scientist who really understands basically emotional maturity, he says, well, we like hats in our tradition, and so we'll give him a special guru hat. Scientific guru hat. And they had all this understanding, but they didn't have this spark of humor and looking at this through the eyes of the Dalai Lama, where he could see that they were taking themselves very seriously. But maybe if they just lightened up a bit. And all their theories are very fine, but it has to do with emotional maturity and being able to confront these things that are difficult and take them lightly. We just don't have to put this heavy burden of self onto the things that we confronted with. This is what Reverend Master talked about Buddhism as a religion for those who wish to be spiritual adults. Because this has to do with your spiritual maturity, to be getting beyond the greeds and the angers and the fears that we are conditioned with from birth, and accepting the responsibility for our lives. That responsibility means we have this old karma that we need to convert. And if we don't convert it in this life, we just pass that on to somebody else. We don't accept the responsibility for converting it in this existence. And all of us here have this incredible gift of being drawn to the Dharma. And now it's your opportunity to use that in your daily life to see what it is that you need to do about your emotional immaturity and see where that those fears and greeds and angers and impatience and that kind of stuff comes up all the time. And you just have to learn to let it go. This lifetime is not about me, it's about getting rid of me. And you don't get rid of it, you convert it to something else. You don't have to get rid of any of this stuff, you just have to use it. It all can be helpful. It's like the lady with no arms could be a wonderful poet. The lady who couldn't hear could be a wonderfully loving person and express that from her heart because she had to. And there's no judgment. The Eternal is not judging us. We're the ones who judge things. And as you see you're judging things, let go of it. The minute you see you've put a judgment on something, that's like poison. It's like sticking your hand at a rattlesnake. You're just not, just learn to not do that. Don't go there. It doesn't help. The Eternal doesn't judge. There's a book I read recently by a woman who had cancer, which she found out later developed because of her fear of cancer. And she had this near-death experience and was able to see for her what the cause was because she was so terrified. And within days of her coming back from this experience, there were no cancer cells left in her body. And she's going around telling about everybody how to live fearlessly. Because if you feed into those fears, you'll create the very thing that you're afraid of. Because fear and attraction are really in the same place. And so what you have to learn to do is to see how to leap beyond the fear. That's where you find the heart of compassion. And that's part of this conversion process of changing your perception. If something looks really awful or terrified or you're fearful, well, take a good look at it. Maybe it's not quite so bad as you thought. I remember some years ago making a list of all my fears. I thought, well, I better do something about these. What are they? And I looked at this list and I thought, oh, well, it all happened in one form or another and I'm still okay. But it was really helpful just to make a list of them and just to look at it and see, oh, that's what I'm afraid of. And fear is, most of the fear has to do with the not looking at those things that are difficult or painful. And if we can look at them, like for a priest, the first thing you do at a funeral ceremony is to allow the sight of the dead to enter your mind. Because we're all going to end up in that same position. And to be open to that, just allow the sight of the dead to enter your mind. Look at those things that you might think are fearful. Achan Chah was terrified of sitting in a graveyard in a cemetery. But he did it, and he meditated with his eyes closed. So he had his sitting there, and he was terrified. He felt something coming up around him. It was out of some spirit or something. But he was determined just to be there. No matter how fearful it got, he was going to just sit there. And by the morning, he had leapt beyond his fear. And he was a very different person because he was able just to be there in the midst of this really incredible, intense fear and just experience that and realize that he wasn't harmed. Because karma is cleansed by having these feelings pass through. We don't have to turn them into something else. We just have to be the vehicle through which they pass. And our willingness just to be that vehicle is to not worry about how these strong emotions are affecting us, just to be there with them. They're just something we can learn from. And if we open our hearts and say, well, what can I learn from this pain? Or what can I learn from this fear? It's like my friend who was dying of AIDS, and I asked him, I said, how are you doing, John? He said, well, I had a new pain. I said, well, what did you do with it? He said, well, I explored it. And my heart just leapt for joy at this teaching because he was going to look at it like he was looking at the Buddha or looking at this picture of Manjushri. He was just looking. He was just experiencing it, just going into that, seeing what it was. He was dying of AIDS, which was very painful. This was almost 30 years ago. And they didn't have a lot of the medications they have now. And he just did it with his open heart, exploring the pain. And it's a really incredibly helpful teaching that I come back to again and again. But when we're in the midst of this ourselves, we're deceiving ourselves about something, it's very hard to see that we're deceiving ourselves because we've bought into the delusion that there's something to be afraid of or something I don't like or something that's really awful. And it's like the fear of global warming. Well, it could get really awful, but we're okay right this minute. And we can do what we can do, and hopefully the laws will change and we can maybe help those things along, but come back to the present moment. If we project out what's going to happen, our worst fear will be, oh, this is awful and we can't live with this forever, I might as well just kill myself. And that's how that despair works. And what we have to learn is that if we come back to right now, well, it's okay, I had breakfast. A nice cup of coffee. We even had persimmon yogurt with our granola. Woo! It's just this present moment is okay. And the more we're okay with ourselves, the more we're okay with whatever is happening. And realizing those external conditions are not the source of the suffering. If we're taking those and experiencing those as suffering, it's because of how we react. It's not because of the conditions. There were Tibetan monks who were tortured by the Chinese, and the ones who were really deeply into their meditation were able to take it without it being a hell for them. And that's what Kishta Garba does. He goes to the gates of hell and tells everybody they don't have to go there. You don't have to go there. You do not have to create suffering for yourself. And that's the bodhisattva mind that's willing to sit there in the midst of hell and tell everybody, no, you don't have to go there. And we have to see, when we deceive ourselves, we're experiencing suffering. So every time we're experiencing suffering, look at that and say, well, what is it that I don't understand here? Because the experience of suffering is an experience of our own ignorance. When there's something we don't understand, we will take that as suffering. And if you experience the suffering and ask the question, what can I learn from this? How can I see the Buddha in this? What the Buddha said here is that everything, let me read this quote again, because it's really important. The Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas who dwell in samadhi, for them visual awareness, the visible objects and the object of mind as well, are like elaborate mirages that appear in space. They have no real existence of their own. Fundamentally, visual awareness and all its conditioned objects are pure, wondrously understanding enlightenment itself. How could there be an identity or lack of it? Everything is the Buddha nature. Manjushri, I now ask you, you are Manjushri. Is there a Manjushri about whom one can say that is Manjushri? Or is there no such Manjushri? Neither, world-honored one, I am simply Manjushri. There is no one about whom one can say that is Manjushri. Why? If there were, there would be two Manjushris. If you look at your opinions about other people, there are two of them. There's yours, and then there's theirs. And you've created this monster because you created this thing that is, doesn't have the Buddha nature, that's just an awful being. The Buddha said, the same is true of the wondrously understanding essence of our visual awareness and also the objects we observe and of all space. All are the wondrously understanding Supreme Enlightenment, the pure, perfect, true mind. It is a mistake to consider them as separate, as observed objects, space, and visual awareness, or as awareness of sound and other kinds of awareness. You want to know Manjushri, you have to be Manjushri. You can't just think that is Manjushri. That's just a picture from a calendar 30, 40 years ago. And this nice old frame that's been brought back to life. This is the frame of our frame up of our selves. We create this picture of ourselves and hold on to it. And think, this is me. But there is no me. But if you think you're a Buddha, then you're equally deluded. If you think you're not a Buddha, you're equally deluded. You just have to learn to act like the Bodhisattva. So let's end with the Bodhisattva vows. However innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, thanks for putting up with me.